with its countless deities and many languages and regional cultures, the ancient civilization of India is one of the oldest on the globe. Yet the Republic of India is one of the youngest countries, only 68 years old as of yesterday. Independence came at the stroke of midnight on August 15, 1947. As that moment approached, the British hastily drew the lines of the subcontinent's partition. This left a mostly Muslim Pakistan to the north and east, and an India with a Hindu majority, though it still has many Muslims, Sikhs, and other groups. By separating them, the partition of the two countries caused one of the most massive human migrations in history. It uprooted 15 million people and caused the death of another 1 million. The British tactics of dividing up colonized communities and pitting them against one another had brought power to the empire. Now it set the stage for bloodshed. Though the freedom struggle had used nonviolence to win independence, the partition unleashed vengeance. Villages were burned. People were lynched, tortured, raped, slaughtered. Nisid Hajjari writes, "Foot caravans of destitute refugees fleeing the violence stretched for 50 miles and more. As the peasants trudged along wearily, mounted guerrillas burst out of the tall crops that lined the road and culled them like sheep. Refugee trains were ambushed multiple times on their way to the border. Torn by rage from any sense of unity, people attacked those with whom they had previously struggled in solidarity for independence." Hajjari's recent book attributes the driving energy for partition less to the hostilities of ordinary people and more to infighting and rivalries among leaders of the struggle. One of Gandhi's early allies and later opponents was Ali Jinnah, the head of India's Muslim League. Though a Muslim, Jinnah was westernized and secular in his outlooks and moral habits. Jinnah mistrusted Gandhi in part because of Gandhi's spiritual emphasis, and he addressed him as Mr. Gandhi, not by the spiritual title Mahatma. Jinnah is quoted as having said it was a crime to mix up politics and religion the way Gandhi did. Ali Jinnah supported partition. Gandhi was against it, but Gandhi's Congress party did not back him. Partition agreements included reparations to Pakistan for lost territories. When Indian leaders wouldn't pay the reparations, Gandhi went on a hunger strike for weeks. To stop his fast and avoid a mass uprising, Indian authorities did pay the money. In 1971, more bloodshed caused the creation of Bangladesh out of the part of Pakistan in the northeast of India. Ever since partition, India and Pakistan have eyed each other with fear and suspicion. The author, Nisid Hajjari, says their relationship now is getting more dangerous. The two countries' nuclear arsenals are growing, militant groups are becoming more capable, and rabid media outlets on both sides are shrinking the scope for moderate voices. By several measures, India is seven times as big as Pakistan. Pakistan's leaders have relied on terrorist militants as proxies to push against India. And now the military has lost control over the Taliban and groups like them. Meanwhile, India's new governing party rejects dialogue with Pakistan. My first encounter with India's government took place in late 2003 in a crowded, windowless office where I sat in a row of hard plastic chairs under fluorescent lights. I was at the Indian consulate in San Francisco, California. I had just filled out a visa so I could visit India for 5 weeks during a sabbatical from the church I was then serving. In that closed-up room, it seemed like a long wait. Finally, the window at the counter flew open, and a clerk barked my name. When I approached the metal bars of the window, I got a harsh response. On the form, I had listed my occupation as clergy. Now I had to fill out an additional form. On this, I had to promise that I would not be evangelizing, organizing, or preaching in India. Nor would I take any religious materials to distribute. This gave me pause. I was planning to visit the remote Unitarian churches of the Khasi tribal people in far northeast India. What if they ask me to give a sermon when I'm there? I guess I better not bring that up now. So I just wrote on the form what they wanted me to write. A few days later in San Francisco, I chatted with a teacher of Buddhism and a peace activist. He explained that the ruling party, the BJP, was right-wing with a Hindu nationalist agenda. Not only did the BJP stir up antagonisms with Indian Muslims, he said, but the party leaders feared Christians as well. Of course, they were a bit late for this fear, given that Catholic, evangelical, and other Christian churches have been part of India's religious diversity for centuries. Indeed, tradition has it that the Apostle Thomas traveled all the way to the south of India back in the year 52. In Kerala, a lush green state down on the southwestern coast, many people call themselves St. Thomas Christians, and Thomas is the most common name for males. For a few days, I stayed at the home of one such Christian man and his wife in a rural area. In 1990, he founded a non-governmental organization, what we call a not-for-profit. He runs dozens of social service, education, and economic development programs for destitute people in his area. He funded it by selling off most of his inherited land. On the remaining parcel, he built a large concrete house with dormitories for guests like me and others. For a few weeks every year, he and his wife host a group of students from a women's college in Japan. He makes peace delegations to Japan and elsewhere, especially for his work to reduce nuclear weapons proliferation around the world. At the house with me were two young Japanese students, women students, staying for an extended immersion in the organization, teaching and helping out in its programs. It was clear that Thomas was well connected. Through his activism, he'd become a friend of the author Arundhati Roy. She wrote The God of Small Things. I thought this was cool, until I understood that this meant I was staying in the home of a troublemaker. On my first night in his house, Thomas told me the government lied about its nuclear weapons testing. He had gone to weapons testing sites to take photographs to prove otherwise. The authorities detained him and broke his camera. Next time, we'll break your arms. If you don't stop this, Thomas, we'll arrest you and put you away. On what grounds? He inquired. They'd find something, they assured him. He guessed that they might plant fake evidence against him. I imagined government agents bursting through the doors of this house during what I had expected to be my quiet rural visit. Nothing like that happened, however. Thomas was darker, pudgier, and younger looking than Gandhi seems in those classic black and white photographs of him. But like the Mahatma, my host was cheerful as he told of his encounters with the harsh machinery of power. During the day, he took me out on his motorbike. I saw a sewing class, childcare and literacy programs. I saw a project installing latrines in villages. In the countryside, he showed me quaint Christian churches where Christian craftsmen had carved images of elephants and other Hindu deities in the decorative wooden doorways. After a big lunch, we napped inside through the hottest part of the day. And then we went out to see volunteers serving up cooked food to a line of people beside a pickup truck. It reminded me of pictures of relief programs during the Depression of the 1930s. We saw an open-air hospital with frail patients lying on mats on concrete floors. It looked more like a parking garage of ailing humans. That night, Thomas and his wife invited me to join them and their young Japanese guests in prayer. Sitting in a circle on their cool, polished concrete floor, we chanted songs whose refrains were easy to repeat in the local language, but impossible to understand. The only words I could identify were Abraham and Sarah, the first family of the monotheistic religions. Intimate visits like this one taught me that India's population is more diverse than I had imagined. It's blessed with so many creative and committed citizens. And the country has a greater variety of opinions than the BJP, Hindu Nationalist Ruling Party, wants people to know about. Later in 2004, the BJP was voted out of power. Now it's back in power, elected just a little over a year ago. India's new prime minister is a controversial figure. Back in 2002, when he, Narendra Modi, was the leader of the state of Gujarat, he stood by during mass riots while hundreds of people were slaughtered. While many Hindus also died, many more Muslims were killed and injured. Modi was suspected of orchestrating much of that sectarian violence, or at least condoning it. It's an irony that he comes from Gandhi's home state of Gujarat. When Modi was the leader of Gujarat, the U.S. government barred his entry here. Now he's the prime minister, and we have to deal with him. Reports out of India show his government is not willing to tolerate criticism of its agenda. The Human Rights Watch website says, the government has conducted harassment and arbitrary arrest of activists, particularly those organizing protests against development projects. Caste and religious-based discrimination is rampant. Censorship is on the rise. The government has failed to take strong action against ultranationalist or extremist groups that threaten violence, nor against abusive security forces. The government considers environmental activists to be threats to national economic security. In April, the government froze the bank accounts of Greenpeace in India, saying that it's a front for foreign intervention. Yet Greenpeace asserts that 70% of its funding comes from Indians, not to mention it has Indian staffers and volunteers. According to Foreign Policy magazine, the government does court foreign investment in defense, roads, and other industries. Yet it fights foreign donations to groups engaged in human rights and environmental advocacy. In April, the government canceled the charity registration of 9,000 non-governmental organizations that receive money from overseas donors. What an irony. Mohandas Gandhi led a nonviolent mass movement of ordinary people to resist an unaccountable foreign government. And now their own government is repressing rights and harassing civic organizations. Today's Indian activists carry on the struggle for justice. To be sure, there are more civic freedoms and religious tolerance in India than in Pakistan or Bangladesh. Also, as the world's largest democracy, there is the potential to change the course of government policies. Brave and persistent Indians are committed to such a change. Gandhi, no doubt, would be appalled to see citizen action suppressed. He'd be heartbroken to see politicians allow sectarian violence, even support it. I'm not an expert about India, yet I love the people I met there. I admire those who engage in the work of justice and service, healing and hope over there. I'm sure they would appreciate our continued awareness of their struggles and our help and care for them. I think it would hearten them to know that we are holding them in our hearts, holding them in prayer, holding them in hope. Before independence came to the people on midnight, August 15, 1947, the British had ruled them for three centuries. Gandhi led the freedom struggle for nearly three decades. By strategy, persistence, and the sole force of his deepest commitments, Gandhi led them to a new place. He did not give up on his hope of human unity. Let us not either. He did not give up on the power of ordinary people to improve their world. Let us keep our faith in that same power, which lives in every human soul. Let us work, strive, give, and pray for the power of love, truth, and courage to blossom evermore from every human soul. So may it be. Blessed be. Amen.